Case number 16-7124. Paul D. Casey, individually and as administrator of the estate of Patrick B. Casey et al. Appellants versus McDonald's Corporation et al. Mr. Klopkoff for the appellants, Mr. Bottiglieri for Appley McDonald's Corporation et al., and Mr. Schwinn for Appley RAH of Washington, D.C., Inc.
May it please the Court. My name is Brendan Klaproth, and I represent Paul and Abigail Casey. This is a wrongful death case brought by Paul and Abigail Casey on behalf of their son, Patrick Casey. On September 23, 2011, Patrick Casey was attacked and killed in a McDonald's restaurant. This particular McDonald's restaurant had a history, significant history.
He wasn't killed in the restaurant.
He was killed just outside the restaurant. But this restaurant did have a significant history of violent crime occurring in the restaurant. And despite that knowledge of the crime, the restaurant failed to take reasonable precautions to protect their customers, including Patrick Casey. In addition, the assailants at the time of the attack were intoxicated. They had been to 8 bars preceding going to McDonald's, consumed dozens upon dozens of alcoholic beverages. At approximately 1:38 a.m., they closed out their tab at Camelot, walked across the street to the McDonald's restaurant where the attack occurred. There are 3 issues before the court on appeal. First, the district court erred in dismissing the wrongful death claims on the basis that they were untimely. Second, the district court erred in dismissing the claims against the McDonald's defendants on a motion for summary judgment. And third, the district court erred in dismissing plaintiffs' dram shop claims against the bar defendants. If the court doesn't have any questions, I'll start with the wrongful death issue. So Patrick Casey died on September 27, 2011. Approximately 6 months later, the D.C. Council passed the law, the D.C. Wrongful Death Act of 2012. This law enlarged the statute of limitations from 1 year to 2 years. Plaintiffs filed their wrongful death claims within that 2-year limitations period. Nevertheless, the district court dismissed the wrongful death claims on the basis that the prior one-year statute of limitations applied. Court error for 3 reasons. First, when a new statute of limitations is passed that enlarges the limitations period, the new limitations period applies to existing unexpired claims. Second reason the court erred is that procedural statutes apply retroactively. And this circuit has held that statute of limitations are considered procedural statutes, which apply retroactively. And third, the D.C. Council clearly intended to pass, in passing the Wrongful Death Act of 2012, to enlarge the statute of limitations in relation to victims of the South Capitol Street murders that occurred in 2010.
And that's your strongest point in some ways, right? Because we know from the resolution that that's what the D.C. Council was motivated by, that they intended to bring those claims within. And if that's true, then you win, if that's true, right?
That's correct. And the important thing is those claims for those victims had already expired. So the statute actually revived those expired claims, whereas here, the statute of limitations never expired.
I mean, that's icing on the cake, but the threshold point is that we know, if we believe that part of the D.C. Council's actions and its motivation as expressed in the resolution, we know that they intended it to apply to retroactively. This is a helpful question to you.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah. And but what about the legislative history that uses the phrase prospective? How do we reconcile those two things?
So I think there's 2 points there. First is the statute itself and the resolution clearly state the purpose and who this statute of limitations was to apply to. Mm-hmm. And judicial canons tell us that the analysis stops there with the plain text of the statute and the resolution. There's no need to go to the legislative history because, as we know, typically committee reports are not drafted by the entire council, just a few members of the particular committee. And the second point is, I think, the interpretation of the word perspective, as we know from the Wilson v. Pena case, doesn't necessarily mean that the statute, I think it's too far a logical leap to say, because the word perspective was used, that it's not meant to be applied retroactively. Because in Wilson v. Pena, the court said, basically, what this statute does is it applies to prospective events, namely the filing of a lawsuit. With respect to the McDonald's defendants, as I stated earlier...
I'm not sure that's your strongest point, but not sure you need it either. I mean, the first point is that the perspective was in the legislative history. But if it did, if it were in the text of the statute and we didn't have the reference to South Capitol, a statement that this is intended to be prospective would be problematic, I would think. But in any event, you don't need to climb that hurdle necessarily.
Well, right in the context of reviving the South Capitol Street claims.
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Or retrospectively in terms of reviving the South Capitol Street claims. I mean, that's another way to reconcile the statement. Mm-hmm. Since the district court relied on that, yeah. All right, and didn't look at the South Capitol.
That is correct. It was in the record with respect to the resolution and the history of the South Capitol Street murders. And I think the analysis should stop just looking at the statute itself and the resolution. So with respect to the McDonald's defendants, this particular McDonald's, as I stated earlier, had a significant history of violent crime. And because of that significant history, it created a heightened foreseeability that if the restaurant did not take reasonable precautions to keep their customers safe, that customers would be injured.
Where does that begin and end, though? That's the problem I have with this part of the case, which is, you know, lots of McDonald's around the country have fights after school, after hours, after ones that are near bars. That's pretty common knowledge. It's not just McDonald's, to state the obvious, so don't want to limit it to them. When is the duty, at least under D.C. tort law, imposed for a diner, a McDonald's, to have a security guard present?
So there's no bright-line rule, but what we can do is look to Novak, the Novak decision, where this circuit held staff members testifying that fights would occur once every 2 weeks to a month was sufficient to establish the heightened foreseeability requirement. And here, we have even more than Novak. We have staff members saying that fights would occur once a month. We have video evidence that was independently obtained, taken by customers detailing violent altercations in the McDonald's restaurant. And we also have the MPD incident reports that show violent assaults occurring within the immediate preceding six-month period. So I think based on Novak, we have more evidence than was established in Novak, and therefore there is a heightened foreseeability.
But Novak was a case involving a nightclub, a place where alcohol is actually served. And, you know, we know that, you know, as they say, sometimes there's a fight in every bottle. So how do we extrapolate Novak to a McDonald's, I guess, to kind of get to Judge Kavanaugh's question?
Sure. So with respect to the rule articulated in Novak was that to establish the heightened foreseeability, which creates the legal duty, you look at, is there a special relationship, business invitor, business invitee, which exists in both Novak and this case, and then you look to prior similar crimes. And that's the analysis as far as creating the legal duty. And we believe that the prior similar crimes here far surpass those in Novak.
But does this mean every McDonald's in D.C. or in the country, if the D.C. tort law is consistent with other states, has to have a security guard, and if not, okay, let's say just some McDonald's, and again, I don't want to limit it to McDonald's, diners, fast food restaurants, food gathering places when bars close are notorious scenes of fights. It's kind of common knowledge. So do all of those have to have security guards, which would be a pretty big change, I think, in a lot of practices at diners and restaurants around the country?
I think that's a great question. And I think what the national standard of care requires is that McDonald's restaurants that have this level of violence and this history of violence, the answer is yes. They are required to have security guards. And they're also required to call 911 when it's evident.
And is there sufficient evidence, do you think, or why do you think there's sufficient evidence that there is a national standard of care to that effect in the record? I mean, the expert talks about a few things, but didn't seem to go to support a national standard of care necessarily.
Well, looking to the Butera decision and the Briggs decision, to establish a national standard of care, we look to several things. One, have comparable facilities adopted this standard? Two, has this standard been promulgated? Three, is this standard generally known? And four, is this standard or methodology commonly used within the industry? And I think the expert here, Mr. Foster, established all those factors, even though you only had to establish one. With respect to comparable facilities, there was a deposition of a corporate designee for the 14th Street McDonald's and the Verizon.
But two McDonald's, I mean, first of all, we're limiting it to McDonald's. McDonald's may be ahead of the game on security guards, but the idea that every food establishment that's near a bar that's still open at closing time has a security guard, I mean, that there's no evidence to that effect in the record.
Well, and I don't think the question is necessarily just proximity to being to a bar, but it's having the significant history of violence. For mm-hmm. example, there might be a wine bar nearby or a 24-hour diner. Mm-hmm. But if there's not that level of violence, then no, a security guard would not be required. And, you know, to the point of that there's two McDonald's identified, there was a motion to compel filed dealing with that specific information,
right.
You know, the existence of other McDonald's restaurants in the Washington, D.C. area that had security guards in place. And there's documents that exist that show us that, but the motion to compel was not even decided before the motion for summary judgment.
On the bars, can I ask a question about that, which is the complaint, so that's tossed on a motion to dismiss.
That's correct.
Okay, on proximate cause grounds. Right, and the question is, do you have enough in the complaint with all the bars that are still in the case to keep them in the case on proximate cause? I mean, you talk about Ozio in some detail, and I'll find the paragraphs here. I think it's 28, 29, and 30. But there's not necessarily the same kind of detail with the other bars. Are they all?
Well, the bars that are remaining in the case, they are remaining for a reason, and that deals with Ozio and Camelot at this point.
Right.
The complaint does say, paragraph 23, that, you know, details that the assailants had been bar hopping on the night in question and identifies those bars as the bars they went to. At each of those bars, they were served while they're intoxicated, paragraph 24 of the complaint, and this is Joint Appendix 34. And then, and at the time we filed the complaint, one of the evidence that we had was a bouncer at one of the last bars said that the assailants were drunk and out of control. And this was the last bar they went to prior to
that's Ozio.
McDonald's.
That's Ozio, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Where is Camelot in the sequence? Do we know?
So what discovery has shown that Camelot, they closed out their tabs at 1:38 a.m. From Camelot, finished their drinks, stopped by Ozio briefly, and then went straight to the McDonald's restaurant. And we've done that through credit card receipts.
So it's number 7 in the chain.
It's actually, yes, that's correct. It was number 7. And approximately 1 hour before the actual assault, that's when they left. That was the other. And again, though, I think the question, and I think Rong Yao-Zhu and Marusa are very clear that the question of proximate cause goes to the jury. And we believe that the pleadings here establish a plausible claim for a dram shop violation under the D.C. Code. And the question of proximate cause should not be decided on a motion to dismiss, but rather before a jury.
Well, at a minimum, you would say after discovery, see what's out there.
That is correct.
Yeah.
I see I'm past my time, so.
All right, we'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Joe Bottiglieri on behalf of Coomery and McDonald's Corporation, which I'll refer to as the McDonald's defendants. There are a number of reasons in our brief why we believe that Judge Leon's decision granting summary judgment should be affirmed in this case. I'd like to touch on three this morning. That is plaintiff's failure to articulate a national standard of care, the requirement under D.C. case law of heightened foreseeability, and proximate cause. So first, even if plaintiff proved that McDonald's defendants had a duty, which we don't believe they have here, plaintiffs have failed to articulate a national
standard. Are you not dealing with the wrongful death thing? Sorry to interrupt.
I wasn't going to touch on that this morning, Your Honor. I'm happy to answer questions.
Did you all
Mr.
split that
Schwinn
up?
Can
Got it.
Address that as well.
That's fine. I just want to make sure someone's going to deal with it. Yeah.
Sure.
Sorry, you're on national
standard. Wasn't there, how can they, I guess, how is it appropriate to decide that issue without deciding the motion to compel and allowing plaintiffs some discovery on the practices of McDonald's in the region?
Yes, Your Honor. So the motion to compel was specifically limited to other McDonald's restaurants in the city. And I think in the Briggs case, this court made it very clear that we're not just dealing with the standard for McDonald's. McDonald's could have a security guard in every restaurant and be way above the national standard of care. That doesn't create liability for them. It doesn't raise the duty bar. This court has said, the D.C. Court of Appeals has made clear that the plaintiff needs to show a national standard of care. They need to show what's done in the industry, that there may be manuals, there may be practices that a particular restaurant or a particular company, in this case, practices, but that does not create a standard of care for them. So in that regard, I don't think that that motion to compel would assist plaintiff's counsel. Excuse me. The only thing plaintiff's counsel has been able to point to in this case is Mr. Foster's opinions, which are really nothing more than his say-so. The expert, his testimony is not sufficient if it's just relying on his own personal opinion.
What about this methodology argument?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that fails for several reasons. Mr. Foster relies on this IAPSC, or International Association of Professional Security Consultants. First, that's a methodology for performing risk assessments. It does not say that the national standard of care, what it is for quick service restaurants like this McDonald's restaurant. It doesn't specifically say that these restaurants.
But the risk assessment, why is that irrelevant or improperly used? I didn't see that argument being made.
Well, Your Honor, it's nothing more than a methodology. It's nothing more than a methodology for security vendors like Mr. Foster to assess what their opinions are in terms of the security that a particular restaurant should have. It's not a standard that says you should have security guards.
No, I understand the difference between the methodology and the standard, but he said he used the methodology and he plugged in certain information and he reached certain conclusions. So why is that not sufficient?
Because that does not comply with D.C. law. D.C. law specifically says that you need to know what other, in this case, restaurants are doing in the industry.
So the restaurants that serve liquor would be outside.
That's correct.
All right. So we're just talking about How narrow is this category? What, fast food restaurants generally? Or are those open after midnight? Or are those open in urban areas?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor. I think that's open to debate, and that's part of the problem here. I think the purpose, one of the purposes, or the main purpose, perhaps, of the standard of care is to make sure that people know specifically what specific conduct which they are required to conform. And in this case, we have really nebulous after-the-fact opinions.
No, but so the argument here, as I understand it, is lots of violence at this particular location. It's located in a part of the city where there are a lot of these bars. The bars close. People come to this location, get some coffee, hamburger, sober up. So you have this history. It's documented in police files that arguably would certainly put on notice that maybe some special security is needed at this particular site. So I thought that's what Mr. Foster was focusing on. Am I incorrect?
Well, I think he was, although we would argue with the position that there was lots of crime and this was such a dangerous area. This is right at DuPont Circle at M Street. My office is a half a block away.
You're not there at 3 a.m. on a Saturday night.
No.
Maybe you are sometimes.
Maybe 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But if you look, even looking at what the plaintiff has set forth, we're talking about 11 acts in the 26 months before this incident. It does not rise to that level of the heightened foreseeability that D.C. requires.
Suppose everybody went to intensive care, ended up crippled, paralyzed, et cetera. I mean, how much do you need to show is what I'm trying to argue, if, as you say, the whole purpose of the national standard is to give notice, and McDonald's itself doesn't say you have to have a security guard, but it does indicate you ought to take into account the circumstances you face, and indeed we have this consultant who could assist you in making this type of evaluation, so that the corporation itself has recognized there may be circumstances where additional precautions are needed. And DuPont Circle during the working day is a different place than DuPont Circle at night.
No, that's true, Your Honor. But to answer your question, under that scenario, plaintiff's expert would need to look at other similarly situated restaurants across the country and come back and testify or present a report as to what those restaurants do.
So how do they deal with it? Let me ask you, though, I'm just thinking about the plaintiff. The plaintiff has to hire an expert. They're not going to spend $2 million, preparing an expert testimony. And I don't understand that to be what the D.C. Court of Appeals is requiring. And it seems to me the question is whether, where you have a corporate organization that has put franchisees on notice, and you have a history of violence such that at a minimum you're going to call 911, or you're going to hope that a police officer is cruising by and you signal it. I just wonder how much more a plaintiff has to show for a national standard of care.
I think the requirement under D.C. law, Your Honor, is very specific, and the plaintiff would have to show, he would have to point to other similarly situated restaurants across the country that and look at what they do. And that D.C. law is very specific.
What I'm trying to get you to grapple with here is the national corporation has already recognized that there may be problem areas where additional security is needed. So then an expert comes in and says, this particular area and this particular location has had a series of problems, and we can document them. And so this is not a Wendy's serving school children, you know, first graders after school. This is a very different, very sophisticated area that has a lot of criminal history associated with. So if you're going to have a McDonald's or a Wendy's or anything in this area, you're probably going to need some extra security for after midnight. That's what the expert said, didn't he?
I think in part that's what he said, Judge. The problem is it's simply his own opinion. It's not based on anything other than him saying that he did a risk assessment based on this methodology. It's not based on any standard of care. And I think, following up on Judge Kavanaugh's point earlier, that, you know, where do you draw the line as to when a security guard is needed and when it isn't? And I think under the Briggs case, I think under the Varner versus District of Columbia case, I think the D.C. Court of Appeals has been clear, and this court has been clear, that a national standard of care has to be established. And that's not
but
true.
But doesn't Clark say or suggest that it can be established by looking at comparable facilities, and you don't necessarily have to have, you know, done a comprehensive survey of everywhere around the country?
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't think a comprehensive survey needs to be done. But I think enough needs to be done in order to be able to testify as to what the national standard of care is, what the care, what the duty is that's established based on what other similarly situated restaurants are doing. And that was never done in this case. In this case, Mr. Foster simply just gave his opinion and nothing more.
Well, he was called as an expert witness, correct? And he submitted an expert report. So I didn't see, he wasn't disqualified as being...
No, he wasn't disqualified, Your Honor, but Judge Leon did find that he failed to articulate a national standard of care.
And I understand that, and I understand the case law, and I thought you might be arguing to me that, well, Novak tightened up the Briggs standard, but I just wonder what that means when the national organization has recognized that, not that everybody needs a security guard, but there may be circumstances. And then an expert says, look, we have this history of crime, violent crime. It's continuing. The location. And he says, you know, looking at this risk assessment, it is my opinion that you need a security guard. So that is what you're going to get in an expert report. And the fact that somebody in Utah, in a rural area, doesn't have a security guard where they have a franchise or a McDonald's, it's very irrelevant.
Two things, Your Honor. With regard to the national organization, the Briggs case made it clear that plaintiff can't establish a duty of care based on the internal policies of a particular company. And the McDonald's manual, to be clear, never suggested that, you know, you have to hire security guards in this type of circumstance. They talked about when security guards might be helpful for crowd control, not applicable here, robberies, not applicable here. So the internal manual doesn't even apply here that McDonald's had. But to your second point with regard to what a restaurant in Utah
so
might
okay.
be doing.
You need a security guard if you have robberies, but not if people are assaulted.
Well, Your Honor, it's just that they don't think it would be helpful.
Well, I'm trying to think of the reverse. If McDonald's were the plaintiff and trying to present expert testimony, you have the resources that you could come in with a comprehensive statement. I don't see that's what the law is requiring, but I do get your point. I don't want to.
But I don't think it would take a lot of resources for the expert to ask around and find out what the standard is. Not in
your point is that the standard isn't, or correct me if I'm wrong, there isn't such a standard.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is no specific standard, and if there is one, he needs to find it and point it out, which he hasn't done.
So there are no national guidelines or anything like that?
No.
It would have to be an empirical study.
Well, I don't know that it would need to rise to an empirical study, but he would certainly need to find out what the similarly situated restaurant, not one in a rural area of Utah, for example,
right.
but a similarly situated restaurant, what those other similarly situated restaurants,
so
not just McDonald's, but all companies are doing.
Do you agree that the motion to compel would have provided additional information, or that's what the
not
plaintiff
all,
was
Judge.
Seeking? And why would
no.
that information be irrelevant?
Because he's simply asking for what other McDonald's restaurants in the District of Columbia are doing. And what McDonald's is doing does not create a standard
yeah,
of care.
I understand.
It could be above the standard.
It's hard to pick up on Judge Rogers' point to establish this then. I mean, maybe that's where the law is.
I don't know, Judge, and I've thought about that. And, you would think, well, if a security expert is being hired, they would have a good sense of how to go about establishing that. And maybe it's talking to other experts in the field. Maybe it's talking to the National Restaurant Association. Maybe it's talking to other associations and trying to figure out what restaurants do in these types of circumstances and then come back.
Of course, we're not the final arbiter. The only question here is whether a jury should be the final arbiter of whether there's sufficient evidence of negligence by not living up to the national standard of care. I mean, the traditional function of tort law was to push safety innovations based on jury's evaluations of the costs and benefits of various measures.
Yes, Judge, but the question of duty is a question for the court.
Right. No, I understand the case law.
Yes.
I take your point.
But,
yes.
This all grew up in contexts where there were national standards that were promulgated by the electricians, by the plumbers, et cetera, by the construction industry. Nobody cited any guidelines from the National Restaurant Association, and indeed you can see where they might have a conflict of interest in doing so, in saying that everybody needs to have a security guard.
I agree, Judge, but for example, in Novak, there weren't promulgated standards, but the expert talked about how every other bar that he's looked at or known posted a security guard at the door for when people are leaving. They couldn't think of a bar in the District of Columbia where they didn't do that. You know, those were the types of things that they presented to establish a standard of care. None of those things were done here. We simply have Mr. Foster's personal opinion on what should have been done, and our point is that that's, under D.C. case law, that's inadequate. I'm over my time.
Please, but you had a couple of other points. Do you want to make them?
Yes, I was going to touch on proximate cause and the heightened foreseeability. I think we touched on the heightened foreseeability in discussing Novak.
All right.
And I would just like to point out that what we're talking about here is 11 acts within the previous 26 months. And this was also a situation where Patrick Casey could have walked away. He could have chosen not to confront the ward group. So when you look at the sliding scale analysis that the D.C. Court of Appeals applies, this in
that's going to be true in every fight.
Yes.
Right.
Someone could have walked away.
Well, right. But he wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't like he was in our custody as a school or he was in a hospital. In a hospital room. I mean, this
so
was
don't
something.
Don't go to McDonald's after midnight.
I'm sorry.
So the message is, don't go to McDonald's after midnight.
No, Your Honor. I think the message is that we were not in control of him, and under the sliding scale analysis that the D.C. Court of Appeals has applied here,
right.
that there is a heightened foreseeability that the plaintiffs have not met here.
Okay.
Lastly, with the proximate cause, with regard to proximate cause, and I know the bar defendants are going to address that as their concern, but with regard to the McDonald's defendants, I think it's important to realize here that we have video surveillance, and there's a counter on the video surveillance, and it shows the timing. And really what we're dealing with is the last 20 or 30 seconds, arguably, in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, when maybe things have started to get heated in the last 20 or 30 seconds. And under that scenario, there wasn't anything that a security guard could do other than ask them to leave, which they were doing anyway. Before the punch was thrown, there just wasn't, even if 911 was called at that point, there just wasn't anything that could be done.
No prevention. All right, we will hear from counsel for
Thank you.
Thank you.
Perhaps Steve Schmidt and Jordan Coyne representing RAH of Washington.
Yes.
And Osio, which I referred to in our brief, was the nightclub defense. It could be bar defense or nightclub defense, whichever. Judge Neon properly concluded that none of these bar defendants, if you will, could be held legally responsible for the unfortunate death of Mr. Casey because it was the direct result of an intentional and possibly a criminal act of Jason Ward. There's really two components to it. They both turn on foreseeability. But
can we talk about the wrongful death statute first?
Your Honor, I was not prepared to address that argument. I will say, though, that we were going to submit on, because of the time constraints, we were going to submit on the briefs, as I understand the argument, though I can tell you, I was there at the time. I think that the point is that at the time of the event that gives rise to the claim, the statute of limitations was 1 year. And that statute had not yet expired when the law had changed. And there's nothing in
the
law.
Yeah, but this is a question. I mean, I'm just going to throw out my theory, and you can respond, or other counsel can respond. This is a question of state law, in this case, D.C. law. And the question is whether the subsequent statute expanding the statute of limitations applies here retroactively. I'll use that word. And if you look at the resolution that says this was specifically designed for the South Capitol Street murders, it seems open and shut as a matter of D.C. law that, yeah, it was designed to expand the statute of limitations to 2 years. And there you go.
I guess the
you don't articulate, like, that would be unconstitutional, which I don't think it necessarily would under current law. So it's just a matter of state law. And the number one response to that is, well, there's something in a committee report that says prospective. And my response to that would be it's a committee report, and it's even weaker in this case because the committee report seems to be directly contradicted by the resolution, which was passed by the city council.
It was a resolution. I don't know if that wording came into got the votes in the actual final version of the law that the this was designed to help the people in that event. But
okay.
The fact of the matter is, you know,
right.
As I understand,
well, I have your briefs on that.
You know,
so
to look at the retroactivity would have to be in the law itself. That's what I understand the argument.
Okay.
But I want to talk about foreseeability as it affects duty under common law torts and also proximate cause.
Yeah, how can that be done on a motion to dismiss proximate cause?
Proximate cause, if in a case like this. Yes, in a case like this, the plaintiffs allege that Mr. Casey was killed by Jason Ward more than an hour after he was served the last beer at any of the bars. And a block away, arising from really a dispute.
Suppose the bar had served someone who then went out and got behind the wheel and ran someone over.
That has been recognized as a legitimate claim in the District of Columbia since the Soe case, as I understand.
And how is this different? Even if the accident.
This case is completely different, Your Honor. This is what I think is because. In Soe and in the later cases as well, they've always talked about a bar could be responsible if an injury of the kind that the statute was designed to prevent occurs. That is, and they say it right in the first sentence of Soe and also in their holding, accidental injuries. And in the later case of Jennifer, in that case where a young man, 19-year-old man, got lost and ended up on Rock Creek Parkway.
Well, what if the
it was also an accident? Nothing on purpose.
What if the customer goes out and intentionally, to the extent you can when you're drunk, intentionally runs someone over?
Well, that's where we say the court properly drew the line, and this court should also.
Does that line make sense to you? I mean, a bar serves someone to the point that they're totally done and it's known. Yeah, I'm not saying those are the facts here. So just take my hypothetical. It's obvious that the person is completely out of control and drunk, and the person goes out, instead of getting into an accident driving home, intentionally runs over someone they're having a fight with outside.
I don't think there's any support for that in the D.C. law, and the reason is because the Alcohol Beverage Control Act, as interpreted by the D.C. Court of Appeals in So, and also in the later case of Jennifer Restaurants versus Woodward Restaurant, held that these were accidental injuries of the kind that were intended to be prevented by this regulation. And if you think about it, in terms of duty, which I think the court this decision turned both on lack of duty, heightened foreseeability, and also on proximate cause, that there were just not sufficient facts to show the temporal and causal relationship.
Sorry to interrupt. It's very hard to do that on a motion to dismiss. I can see it if you go through discovery. They're just kind of standard intoxicated rather than really out of control intoxicated at a bar. But we haven't been through discovery. All we have are the allegations in the complaint here.
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, that the line has to be drawn, and it has to be a clear line of demarcation. Judge Leon and a lot of other courts across the country have drawn that line between accidents due to the effects of alcohol, impairing mostly their ability to drive a car, which everyone recognizes is a foreseeable risk and something that we've all recognized and there's a lot of support for, and it's fair that they should be responsible for that. On the one hand, accidents, and where they draw the line, on the other hand, is intentional or criminal acts, such as, in this case, sucker punching a guy and knocking him cold.
Wasn't it an accident in the sense that it was not intended to kill him?
Well, no, it's
he intended to punch him. He didn't intend to kill him. Presumably. Who knows?
It was an intentional act, and he intended to put him down. He intended to hurt him, which is where the court has to draw the line. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, where would you draw the line?
I agree.
You can't draw it. You can't leave it open to a jury to decide if this philanderer, who then, maybe sexually assaults somebody on a train, whether the bar should be responsible for that because they served him a beer an hour and a half ago.
It's not just serving a beer. That's the thing. I just want to challenge that because I understand your concern representing your client that every customer who goes out and does something stupid afterwards, which is going to cast a wide net, you don't want to be liable for all that. But it's someone who's obviously out of control, an immediate risk.
The code says if you serve someone who's intoxicated or underage, then you could a bar owner could be liable for the accidental injuries that flow from that intoxication, but never any intentional injury. There's never been anything anywhere that would extend the law to cover intentional injuries. That, the law of the District of Columbia for quite some time.
So a DUI, I just want to make sure I understand this. So like a DWI, a customer is totally wasted, goes out and does a DUI and runs someone over, the bar owner can be liable, but if the guy goes out and rapes someone,
but if you went out to
not
rape,
liable?
No. You wouldn't be liable for... Well, you're right. And those examples. You're not liable for... You are liable for accidents, but not intentional acts. Crimes.
So DUIs, yes. Rapes, murders, assaults,
DUI,
no?
The person charged with DUI or causes an accident didn't go out intending to murder that person. If he did, then I'd say that we wouldn't be responsible for that either. And there's
and what's the best case law for that?
The best case law for that is the...
or is it the absence of case law?
It's both cases. The leading precedent here is Sue, So, and Jennifer. And I wanted to talk about Marussa because the appellants rely entirely on Marussa. And I apologize for this. I need to point out something that wasn't... I need to amplify something that wasn't covered well enough in our brief. We talked about how Marussa was not binding because it was after the Home Rule Act, Courts Act, that it was really not that helpful because it doesn't give much factual context. The only thing we know is that the police officer, Clark, was exceedingly drunk and shot his gun as soon as he left. But one thing I didn't cover, which I think is very important to cover in this duty context, is that Marussa was decided before the litany of cases coming out of the D.C. Court of Appeals that require this heightened standard of care to be shown to give rise to a duty to protect somebody from an intentional criminal act. So again, that foreseeability, and it's only, as Judge Scalia put it, it's really a matter of fairness. When an intervening act involves a criminal rather than negligent conduct, the question is not simply whether the criminal event is foreseeable, but whether a duty exists to take measures to guard against it, which is ultimately a question of fairness. And you can analyze it just as it's always a matter of law for the courts to decide, and you analyze it based upon the several factors, the foreseeability of the harm, the degree of certainty that the plaintiff is going to sustain that injury, the closeness of the connection between the negligent act and the injury, the moral blame that goes with it, and the policy of preventing harm. Then you decide, that's how the courts decide whether there's a duty in the first place. And the Court of Appeals has held in a series of cases from Safeway, Ellis Safeway in 1979, through Potts and Bailey that we cite in our briefs, all the way up to DeSalvio in 2009, that in order to be held liable for an intervening criminal act, there has to be this heightened standard of foreseeability such that you know with some degree of precision that this crime is going to occur.
Yeah,
otherwise
drunk
it's not
guys
fair.
Coming in at night, you know something's going to happen. They're not sitting at the bar, sitting at the table, calmly eating and drinking coffee. And so maybe you're lucky and they leave without anything happening. But at the point a tussle starts, the manager goes in the bathroom. Sure to solve the problem. He doesn't want any part of it. He knows what's coming. And this is looking at the evidence most favorably in, you know, the light of the plaintiff at this point on a motion to dismiss.
Sure. Rightfully so. And what we're saying is that as far as the duty is concerned, as relates to the bar defendants, not just the McDonald's, because they were present when the events got out of hand, when the name calling started and the physical altercation came to be. That was, again, that goes both to the duty, because it's an intentional, maybe criminal act of punching Mr. Casey, but also the proximate cause. That's also a foreseeability element of proximate cause.
So
this gentleman left more than an hour before.
So the manager can just hide in the bathroom, and all the employees can just look down at the floor and ignore what's going on in the restaurant?
Well, that would be, you know, that pertains to my colleague's client, McDonald's.
I'm talking about the unit.
Oh, well.
DuPont Circuit,
thank you for that.
Your clients.
Let me put it that way. Let me look at that, because the appellants argue that this heightened foreseeability does not apply to dram shop cases at all, right? And what I'm trying to point out is it's because the heightened foreseeability standard hadn't been established by the D.C. Court of Appeals until starting in the 1980s on through 1990.
Well, it's been out there a long time, so your client had noticed before he signed this franchise agreement.
But the allegation of the complaint in this case, as it relates to the bar defendants, was that Mr. Ward, who had been previously at the bar an hour before, intentionally sucker-punched Patrick Casey, causing his death. And all I'm saying is, under the case law from the D.C. Court of Appeals, it's not fair to hold Camelot or any other bars responsible for that conduct because it's intentional, maybe criminal conduct.
Well, I thought that's
different
why
from
these
all the
bars
others.
Have bouncers and have security
guards.
Well,
if this had developed inside,
because
I'm sorry for interrupting.
Their managers don't hide in the bathroom. They get these guys out of there because they know something's going to happen.
We're talking about Novak, and one of the other national standards that was recognized in Novak is that when there are scuffling or battling groups, you never put them out together at the same time. There's no one worth his salt who would put two conflicting groups out the same door.
You don't let them
at
in.
The same time. You hold one and put them out the other door, is what the standard of care would be.
I mean, the DUI situation, you say everybody knows. Well, everybody knows people who are drunk have diminished judgment. And here you had evidence that something was going to happen.
Well, not at the bar. There's no evidence that anything happened at the bar an hour before, you know, when they were last served at the bars.
That depends.
That would be the Novak case. If there was something developing at our bar, then certainly. We'd have that foreseeability of a specific crime that could befall one of our patrons.
So on a motion to dismiss, the argument would be the way the district court framed it. Intentional act interrupts the chain of causation no matter what.
Well, I think it has to with respect to the allegations of the complaint here. It's a criminal act. It's a bright line that has to be drawn to demarcate where a barred defendant's responsibility is going to end and the actor, the criminal actor's responsibility is going to be.
I mean,
and that's
somebody's
where it rests
dead.
With Mr. Ward. That's
dead.
Where the responsibility rests.
This is so serious.
It's
I mean,
very
somebody
sad.
Has died. It's not just sad.
Yes.
It's tragic. Somebody's dead.
And the question is it fair to hold Camelot and the others responsible for that death, or should it rest with the actor who
no
caused the death,
no matter how much,
Mr.
How
Ward.
Much prior notice they had?
Well,
and that's as a matter of law. It doesn't matter how much notice they had.
No, I would take, you know, it's not in the record of this case. I say it might have been in Marusa. In our briefs, we say maybe this Officer Clark was known to be a hothead, a racist, maybe. Who knows what? Maybe he started the altercation in the bar, or he was going out to shoot the first one he saw and said so. That gives you the kind of heightened foreseeability.
I mean, your client's protection
the layer,
is, isn't the layer it, that
rule.
They call 911.
Well, my,
that at least says we tried to do something. We didn't hide in the bathroom.
Remember, my clients are just the bars. I'm not representing McDonald's in this case.
I'm talking to you as
about the bars.
Lawyer who is representing Camelot
yes.
and Osseo.
Well, maybe I misunderstand, because there's no evidence that the manager went to the bathroom at Camelot or Osseo.
Oh, sorry, then that's
that
my
was
mistake.
McDonald's. That
sorry.
Was McDonald's. I'm sorry, it's quite all right. I mean, it is a tragic thing. The point being that foreseeability is important in determining a duty. Judge Down was right to draw the line on duty at the intentional act and stop it there, because that's where it belongs. It's only fair. Otherwise, where would you draw it? And then also on proximate cause, goodness gracious, an hour later, a block away, over an argument that resulted from somebody calling somebody else a fag and then, you know, pushing and shoving and everything else. So, and then Mr. Casey, almost as an invitation to combat, saying, let's take this outside and I'll get you off.
That's all very factual, and I understand that. And that may be a reason for summary judgment.
Well, that all developed after we were granted a dismissal of judgment. Judge Leon dismissed on the proximate cause issue just because he felt that there was not a plausible claim stated because it was so far removed. And that was the other point that I wanted to make, where I didn't amplify well enough in the brief.
I don't know how an hour later, you've said that about five or six times, an hour later, I can see that at the attenuation, but it's not like that's absolution, it would seem to me, for the bar.
True, but, you know, it is a state case, and we're looking at the state law,
right.
District of Columbia Court of Appeals. This is the point that I wanted to make. There was another Casey case, you know, mm-hmm. that was mentioned by the SO court. And it's Casey versus Corson and Grumman, 221 F. Second at 51. That case was very important. Should have had more time in our brief.
That's a D.C. Court of Appeals or D.C. Circuit?
That was a D.C. Circuit case.
Okay.
Before the Court Reform Act, but it was cited with approval by the SO Court, which is the D.C. Court of Appeals, and what established what we call dram shop liability. And they cited this with approval discussing proximate cause issue, because it was going back on remand. And what's so significant about it is that Casey involved another city ordinance, one prohibiting people from leaving ignition keys in the ignition of their cars or vehicles. And the argument was that that was a violation of a safety statute that resulted in a vehicle injury later on. And, you know, but in that case, Judge Holzkopf granted the defendant's judgment at the close of the opening statement based upon the fact that the injury occurred 15 miles south of Petersburg, hours after the truck was stolen. It was so far removed, too remote in time, place, and circumstance for it to have been a proximate cause of the vehicle accident down in Petersburg. Well, those are the same words Judge Leon used in explaining his decision on the motion for reconsideration, that this event, sad as it may be, tragic as it is too far removed from the alleged statutory violation to have been a proximate cause as a matter of law.
Let me make sure I understand your proximate cause argument. Let's suppose that what was alleged in the complaint and what the facts were that all of these people were inside one of the nightclub defendants, and the jawboning began there, and then the bouncers asked them all to leave, and right outside, the fight happens, and Mr. Casey is killed. Are you saying that because it was an intentional act that was committed that resulted in the death, that there wouldn't be proximate cause in that case, and that complaint, if it were alleged that way, could be dismissed on a 12B6 motion?
Thank you for the question, Your Honor. The point, that's a lot like that Novak case, first Novak case, where the scuffle that erupted between two groups of young men happened in the bar, and they were let out into the alley where the fight erupted and went on for several minutes after. And the Court of Appeals felt that that met the requirement of a heightened standard, heightened foreseeability, heightened proximate cause foreseeability, so that there would be liability under this typical tort claim. Now, interestingly enough,
But they didn't reach the dram shop issue.
That's the other point I'm trying to make. The dram shop claim was the only one made against us. There was no claim being made that anything happened at any one of our establishments that would give rise to the heightened standard, the proximate cause, the heightened foreseeability that Ward was going to go and kill somebody tonight. There was no allegation, no evidence, no claim of that. But interestingly enough, Novak didn't talk about dram shop liability, even though it was two groups of young men in a bar. I bet you they were not drinking water. But the plaintiff didn't even claim dram shop liability in that context, and that certainly wasn't the basis for the decision. It wasn't even raised. It certainly wasn't raised as plaintiff's appellants would think it's a per se negligence, right? Negligence per se without any heightened proximate cause required. In that case, it was because of the fight evolving and erupting in the bar and the acts that they took in response that were obviously deficient, according to all the testimony and experience there, and putting them outside together, and then much later having the injury, serious injury occur.
Anything further?
No, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Unless there's a question.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Counsel for opponents.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have a few points I'd like to make. With respect to the dram shop claims against the bar defendants, the court only needs to look to Marusa. Marusa involved a situation where an off-duty officer was overserved at a bar, walked outside the bar, and shot someone. That is an intentional act. That is what created dram shop liability in the District of Columbia. And the court in that decision said the distinction between the intentional act or negligence is a question of proximate cause for a jury.
Well, it didn't exactly say that. If it had exactly said that, it would be 100%. I think you're 90% there. I would drew a distinction between the automobile and the gun.
And I think the distinction there, what you're getting at, though, the court, is the gun is an intentional
right.
act that committed a burglary.
I might agree with you that that's what they're getting at, but they didn't exactly say what you said.
Thank you for the clarification. One other point with the dram shop claim. The issue of it's important to understand the legal duty here because it's not the same. The heightened foreseeability applies in the claims against the McDonald's defendants because that is a negligent security case that falls under Novak. The legal duty with respect to the dram shop is created by the statute and the regulation. And the courts are very clear that once there's a violation of that statute, that legal duty, the issue, the remaining issue is proximate cause. And with respect to proximate cause on the dram shop issue, getting into this discussion about 1 hour, is it too much or is it not enough, that's not a question for a motion to dismiss. And 1 hour.
I mean, the larger question, which maybe is not posed by this case, is how drunk is drunk enough to tram to make a bar liable? Because you know, a couple hundred people stream out, and many, if not the majority of them, are drunk legally, past 0.10 or 0.08 or whatever it may be. And some of them are going to do dumb things that are going to cause injuries to others.
Well, and the statute's written as intoxicated.
And the concern, I guess the concern is, can the bars really be held liable for all that ensues?
Well, so the first question is how drunk is too drunk? That's a question of whether there's a breach of the standard of care. And that's a jury question, right? And with respect to the statute itself, it says intoxicated or visibly intoxicated. And in this particular case, there's plenty of eyewitness testimony that identified or described the assailants as being drunken, out of control, intoxicated, belligerent. So I think that alone would actually get past a motion for summary judgment. But again, we're at the motion to dismiss phase. One other comment.
I'm not going to parse it, but if you're intoxicated but not visibly intoxicated, that's going to be pretty tough for a bar.
I think that situation would probably require expert testimony, or perhaps it's a DUI case where the individual gets pulled over and there's a breathalyzer. Yeah. So I think that's how that would need to be proven, and then backtrack from the time of the last drink to when it dissipated through the blood, the alcohol. Dealing with the McDonald's defendants, there was a comment about the Briggs decision saying manuals cannot be used to establish standard care. I agree with that, but Briggs does go on to say that internal manuals can be used to establish evidence of the standard of care. So by itself can't establish the standard of care, but it is evidence of the standard of care. And here, the McDonald's security manual, coupled with the fact that other facilities, restaurants, have security guards, that establishes a national standard of care.
Do you know that other national restaurants have manuals that require security guards?
In this particular case, I can say the security manual was subject to a protective order and under seal, so I presume other national restaurants would treat that information the same. So to answer your question, I don't have that information. With respect to the number of restaurants required,
counsel. But, I mean, you could have sought it in discovery. I mean, you could issue third-party subpoenas. And then if the information is confidential or trade secret material, then, you know, it could be subject to a protective order, but you could get it.
That is correct, Your Honor. But I think here, looking at the Novak decision, the security expert who also used the same forensic methodology. And by the way, McDonald's security expert also used the same forensic methodology from the IAPSC. But in the Novak case, the expert referred to four other bars that, and the circuit found that was sufficient to articulate the national standard of care. So in this case, we identified, took the depositions of two other restaurants, who then identified a third of their restaurants that had a security guard. And in addition, we have the outstanding motion to compel that we think would have been sufficient evidence without having to do the third party.
Weren't those all corporate-owned McDonald's?
I'm sorry?
Weren't those all corporate-owned McDonald's?
Well, I think that's accurate. But it still goes to the standard of care. You know, the national standard of care is not referring to franchisee-owned restaurants or corporate-owned restaurants. It's similar restaurants. And I think corporate, you know, based on the McDonald's system, which requires uniformity across all their restaurants, that is a good indicator for the national standard.
It requires uniformity as to certain things. It doesn't require uniformity as to security guards, or else, you know, the franchise agreement would say that. It doesn't.
That is correct, but, you know, as far as articulating national standard of care, there isn't, you know, for example, the Med-Mal case. There's not going to be a document that says this is the national standard of care. It's experts who come in and base it on their experience, based on competing facilities, based on treatises, recognized methodologies, and we believe that's what happened here.
Well, counsel, I thought, was making the point, though, that maybe McDonald's, I thought counsel was making the point that maybe McDonald's just operates under a higher standard of care. That's not evidence of a national standard.
Well, so with respect to the two other restaurants, that was done, the decision to hire a security guard had to do with the area in which those restaurants were located. They were located near bars, and the corporate designee testified that what would happen is late at night, they would get this huge influx of intoxicated patrons, and this was done in consultation with the regional security manager for McDonald's Corporation, and due to that influx of intoxicated patrons, they felt it was necessary to hire a security guard to keep their customers safe. And in fact, in those two restaurants, it was testified that there's never been a violent altercation since they've had the security guard. One other point with respect to calling 911, I want to clarify something. The witness testimony is that the verbal altercation and yelling occurred over a 3 to 5 minute period. During this period, the manager from the McDonald's restaurant testified or submitted an affidavit that stated, it was clear from the yelling, everyone in the restaurant could hear the yelling, and it was clear from the yelling there was going to be a fight.
I thought the argument now is that this was never raised below, so it's forfeited.
That was raised below.
All right.
And in fact, our expert even articulated that the national standard of care required the McDonald's restaurant to call 911. And he based that on the fact that the corporate designee for McDonald's Corporation testified that at that moment, McDonald's policy required that they call 911. And so referring to, you know, the 103 McDonald's corporate-owned restaurants in Washington, D.C., that references the national standard of care. But again, that is something that can be, it's well within the province of the jury. Expert testimony is not required for whether the decision to call 911 and it can be decided by the layman based on their common understanding.
I guess what I need to just be clarified is that the parties had agreed in the district court that expert testimony was necessary.
So plaintiff never made that concession. In fact, plaintiffs even cited to the restatement 314A and the Southland decision, which both state, especially in Southland, which is a Maryland case, that in that particular case there was an assault at a gas station. The gas station owner or the attendant or the staff at the gas station saw that there was this altercation was happening, and they failed to call the police. And the Maryland Court of Appeals found that was a basis for liability without any expert testimony. With respect to McDonald's Corporation, which I don't think was discussed, I'll just touch on briefly. The franchise agreement requires, it's the contract between the franchisee and the McDonald's Corporation. It requires that the franchisee adhere to the McDonald's system, which is a uniform set of policies. Part of that McDonald's system includes security manuals or business manuals, which includes a security manual. And the McDonald's Corporation also exercises control of franchises by conducting routine inspections, which includes questions on security. If they fail those inspections, the franchise can be terminated. So we believe that that's an independent source of liability against McDonald's Corporation through the Bechtel case. So if the court doesn't have anything further, I'm happy to continue.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.